A podcast of the cinema.
Hi.
Hello.
Two weeks.
I know we're bouncing back. Sorry, we took a week off, but
yeah.
You're getting this will be covering last week's movies, and then later we'll cover this week's movies on another episode.
Yeah,
we are
recording back to back, and the episodes will post. I'll turn my computer volume down.
That'd be great. You're Dave White, by the way.
Yeah.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde. Welcome.
So I talked about this briefly on the other podcasts that we do.
For our Patreon subscribers.
But I wanted to make sure that it was something I didn't just go on and on and on about, you know, across the... across the various platforms. The reason we were not here last week, we would have not been here anyway.
Yeah.
Because you had a work thing that took you out of the house for two solid days, mm-hmm. and there was no... I mean, I suppose...
We could have worked around that.
When you came back at night at 7 o'clock at night, we could have done a nighttime episode if we were truly...
committed.
You know, workhorses. But a friend of mine died.
Yes.
Right before last weekend. So that kind of took me out of work just in terms of wanting to do anything.
Sure.
His name was Shannon Michael Caine, and he...
You said there was an obit for him in the New York Times.
Today, yes. There was an obit for him in the New York Times. He was... the man who ran the Printed Matter New York Art Book Fair and the Los Angeles Art Book Fair. I knew him for about 10 years, a friend of mine. And I think the part that really... It was sudden. It was a suicide.
Mm.
And the sudden friend death is hard. Harder, maybe, even, than the... than when you know it's coming.
Right.
Like when I was 21, one of my good friends from high school, she died.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. Like everyone knew this is going to happen. And there's something to be said for having a little prep time.
Well, yeah.
You can feel your feelings before the event. And it's worse when it's a suicide. I'm not trying to, like, bum anybody out right now, but... It is shocking when it is someone that you've never known as somebody who struggles with anxiety or depression or any of those things. When your entire experience of that person is an upbeat persona. Not that... And persona is the wrong word, because he really was like that guy. He really was this exuberant, go-get-em kind of guy. And he kept that other stuff away from me. You know, talking with some of his other friends, people who had daily contact with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know.
I see.
Yeah. And... What were you, are you going to read something?
I see you
pulling up your phone.
I just want to throw out there the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 800-273-8255. You know, if you are in a dark place, there are people to talk to.
Yeah. Anyway, it's that thing where, and I'm not going to go on and on and on about this because that's not, I mean, you didn't tune in for... me to have a bummer on you, but the only thing you have as a person who's still alive after this sort of thing is this this moment where you look at your life and you think, am I being the right kind of person? Am I, and I'm not talking about the, you know, am I living life to my fullest? I'm like, am I being...
Are you being there for people?
Am I good? Mm. Are you good? Are you helping and not hurting? Are you, you know, doing your best to take care of your friends and help them? And I, the worst part is that you look at yourself and you're like, I don't know.
Well,
it's the sort of thing where if you are prone to looking inside yourself a lot, mm-hmm. you come away from it thinking, yeah, I'm a disappointment. I am.
Well, yes, and, but I mean, you can do your best. You know?
I know. And so, anyway, this is, you know, that's what happened.
Yes.
And I see him. See, he knew a lot of people. So I see him on Instagram every day, someone talking about him. I see him on Twitter. I see him on Facebook. I haven't even posted on social media in about 6 weeks. Just because before his death, the world had just bummed me out so hard, I didn't even want to look at the news anymore. And this didn't help at all. But I'm still going to my friends' pages and looking at stuff. But all my friends knew him.
Right.
And so I'm seeing him every day. And every day I just think, oh, God, what? Why did this, you know?
Mm.
Okay. So that's what happened. That's where we were.
What we would have talked about last week.
And what we're going to talk about today is what came out last week.
Yes.
So here's the catch-up episode. We have to talk about the following films. Lady Bird.
Mm.
Daddy's Home 2. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri?
Correct.
I always forget the last.
It's a mouthful of titles.
Two words. On the TV spots, they're just calling it Three Billboards.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's probably the hashtag, too.
And then Murder on the Orient Express.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Why don't we get... Daddy's Home 2 out of the way. I did not see it, and I'm not going to see it, and I didn't see Daddy's Home, the first one, because I just didn't feel like I needed that in my life.
Sometimes I envy your life, Dave.
And now I know that I was right to not see the first Daddy's Home, and now I really know that I'm right not to see this one, because Mel effing Gibson.
Yep.
Who, you know what? Well, you talk, and then I'm going to lay down my rap about that dude.
Fine.
All right.
So, yeah, so it's a sequel to the first movie, and, you know, the first movie is all about dad, Mark Wahlberg, who's like a tough guy and wimpy, sensitive stepdad, you know, Will Ferrell figuring out how to, like, co-dad and, you know, be there for the kids and blah, blah, blah. So basically following the Bad Moms Christmas formula, now we have to drag in the parents, in this case, right. The dads of the dads. Right. So Will Ferrell's dad is played by John Lithgow, and Mark Wahlberg's dad is Mel Gibson. Mm-hmm. And it's Christmas, and they all go off to this big cabin, and, you know, hijinks ensue.
Okay.
It's
all right.
It's dreadful, this movie. I laughed.
Why is it dreadful?
Well, I laughed maybe 3 times.
Okay.
What's
wrong with the comedy?
It's not funny. The jokes, there's two kinds of jokes here. The ones that come trampling toward you like a herd of elephants that you can sense where they're going to come, or the jokes that you are given the parameters of a joke and the setup for a joke, but then right. There's never really a joke.
Yeah.
It's, so it's a pain in the ass. And I love Ferrell and Wahlberg in The Other Guys.
But, yeah, The Other Guys.
Which was a funny, hilarious, smart, cool movie.
Yeah.
Hated them in Daddy's Home. Of course, Daddy's Home is the global hit that spawns the sequel. Here's the thing. I saw this movie 2.5 weeks ago. I barely even remember it now. I just know that it was lame and, you know, I'm the world's softest touch for Christmas movies, and this is exploding with Christmas stuff, and it's just not good at all. And as for Mel Gibson,
yes.
I have obviously many issues with him, but you know, Hacksaw Ridge was a well-directed film. Mm-hmm. And even as an actor,
yes,
I saw him in this movie that barely got released last year called Bloodfather,
yes,
which was a very kind of grindhousey movie where he is this like ex-biker recovering alcoholic who has to go rescue his kidnapped daughter from these other bikers. And it's, you know, it's kind of a fun, grimy movie, and he is charismatic in it. And I'm fine with Mel Gibson doing R-rated movies where he plays people with questionable pasts, you know, and all that stuff. But to trot him out for a family comedy where his a-holishness is supposed to be, like, charming and funny, no thank you.
At the height of his troubles,
mm-hmm.
a film called Edge of Darkness came out.
Oh, right, yeah. Was that a remake of something, or am I thinking? I'm thinking of Paycheck, aren't I?
You know what? I don't know, but I do know that he played an obsessed man who, and the character felt like him wrestling with demons. Hmm. Not a great movie, but it felt like he was shrouded in darkness in that film. And maybe intentionally so. And he, it felt, it played like a man who knew he was sort of wrecked up inside and wanting a way out. I think he's gotten over that. Seriously.
Well, yeah, because, I mean,
the Beaver, kind of the same way.
Yeah, but now he's, you know, an Academy Award nominated and officially exonerated Hollywood player again.
And I've decided that I only like him when he is anguished and penitent.
Exactly.
Because he's a jerk. I mean, he's a jerk.
I think that's a nice, safe statement.
That's a nice thing to say about him. Whatever relationship he has with Jodie Foster, where she thinks he's the bee's knees, is whatever. I don't know. They can only explain themselves to themselves and apparently no one else. But I don't want to watch him be like ho at a Christmas movie and be like homophobic at the same time.
Yeah, much of the movie is him wincing at the fact that that Will Ferrell and John Lithgow show each other affection.
Demonstrative kissy face affection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, he is like an unpenitent skirt chaser the whole time, which was, you know, part of a problem that Wahlberg had with him when he was a kid.
Right.
And as an adult, behaves exactly the same way.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's also supposed to be, oh, that roguish rake.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not down. So Bad Moms Christmas is way better
and than that Daddy's sucks.
Home 2. Well, I don't. I like it more than you did, but I definitely like it more than Daddy's Home 2.
So let's quickly move away from this film.
Let's never
speak of it again.
I've already forgotten it.
Let's pretend it no longer exists. Let's talk about three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yes,
from Martin McDonagh.
Mm-hmm.
Who made The Great in Bruges.
Yes.
And the not-so-great Seven Psychopaths.
That's a fair statement, yes.
This is somewhere in the middle.
It is not as great as in Bruges, but it's better than Seven Psychopaths, sure.
Much better.
Much better than Seven Psychopaths, I agree.
Frances McDormand plays a woman who has had an extreme tragedy take place.
Yes.
Her daughter was brutally murdered. And other things as well. And they couldn't find the killer. They don't know who did it. And the local small town cops couldn't solve the case. So she's on a tear. And she erects three billboards to shame the local sheriff.
Into doing something.
And then a lot of things happen.
Yeah, that's pretty much an apt description. And you know, you sort of get an idea of this small town and the sort of the, you know, its it's racial issues and it's, you know, problems of the past and, you know, the relationships of the people who live there and whether they like each other or hate each other. And
it's got not just Frances McDormand, it's got
Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson, Caleb Landry Jones.
Lucas Hedges.
Abby Cornish.
Peter Dinklage, John Hawkes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dark comedy, but it's also about grief and about, you know, vengeance.
There is so much about it that is not comedy, though.
True.
I mean, they're calling it a dark comedy, but it's real heavy.
It is heavy, but at times. Yeah, but I think in that sort of McDonough way, like there is a mordant wit through much of it.
Yes.
And I think it mainly pulls that balance off. It's not to everybody's liking. If you've never heard my other podcast, Who Shot Ya, over on the Maximum Fun Network.
We got into it this week.
About that movie. April and our guest, Ingu Kang, definitely had some issues about how women are portrayed in the film and how issues of sexual violence are handled. And, you know, I think they raise valid points. They were not things that occurred to me while I was watching the film, but... you know, they know what they're talking about. So I couldn't say what your response to this movie will be. I think everyone agrees Frances McDormand's performance is great.
It is.
And you know, I think the film succeeds at what it's trying to do with the tone that it's trying to capture.
Well, the tone jumps around.
Yes.
And that can leave you feeling a little exhausted sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But the net effect for me was a film where real people are experiencing, you know, very difficult life circumstances.
Right.
And responding in weird ways that I don't find implausible. Perhaps, you know, those resolutions are a little too neat at the end. 'Cause real life stays messy.
Of course.
Real life stays messy. Things go unresolved. There's not a narrative arc that takes place over most people's lives.
Right, but I think you might be overstating the case. I think the movie allows for a certain level of messiness. There are some things that occur that don't sort of follow the usual three-act path. And I think even the ending is sort of open to a certain level of interpretation. And while one character gets a certain level of redemption, I don't think is being let entirely off the hook either.
Without spoiling it.
Yeah, I'm trying to talk around this stuff.
Yeah. It's funny, I didn't have that problem with it when I watched it, but now that I'm hearing from people talk about it, I think maybe I need to look at this again.
Yeah, maybe.
So it's, you know, it is occasionally a challenging film.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. Overall, I think it's pretty great.
It's, you know, see it with people that you can have long conversations with about it afterwards.
Without fighting, Alonzo.
I was not fighting with anybody.
I know you weren't. Just, you know. I'm effing with you, man.
Stop it.
Come on.
Stop it.
Who do you know off the top of your head who wrote the review of Murder on the Orient Express? The review that called Kenneth Branagh Whiskers Von Look at Me? Who was that?
I don't know.
Who wrote that? Can I? All right.
I want to give that person the Nobel Prize, though.
I'm going to pause this for a minute so I can look up that. We need to give this person
absolutely
props. We're back. Are you finished with your sad coughing? Are you okay? Are you going
to
die?
What makes my coughing sad?
Well, it's sad to listen to.
You're sad to listen to.
No, I'm a delight.
So is your face.
My face is also a delight.
And sad.
You good, though?
I'm fine.
I'm worried about you. You have the croup or something.
No, I just... Believe me, two episodes ago, people were saying I sounded like Brenda Vaccaro.
No, so I know. That's kids. kids. Brenda Vaccaro.
Was a 1970s Academy Award nominee.
Old-timey TV actress.
Famous for her husky voice.
Also in films. Ella Taylor.
Oh, bless her.
The delightful Ella Taylor.
We should have her on the show sometime.
We should, as she reviewed this film for NPR.
With her darling British lilt.
Called Kenneth Branagh, Whiskers Von Look At Me. I had a gay friend who saw this movie, and he said a terribly dirty sexual thing.
Yes, let's not get into that.
I'm not going to, obviously I'm not going to repeat what he said. About that mustache.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Just don't. I can't believe you even said this.
That is a... it made me... because both of them made me laugh and go ha 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 out loud. That's why.
My favorite thing was the guy who's... I think it was Jim Beaver. Somebody on Twitter who said that his son said, "Oh, are we going to go see Murder on the Polar Express?"
Well, it does take place in a snowy train situation.
And there were times when the CG was so cruddy, I thought, oh, this is Murder on the Polar Express.
I tell you, let's keep talking about the mustache. I was captivated by it. It was the most fascinating thing in the entire film.
But it's distracting.
That's fine, because the movie itself is kind of boring.
Yeah, I mean, like, Poirot, yes, the mustache is sort of famously, you know, fussy or whatever.
But this was like a layered, like a duplex of a mustache.
It's like the kind of thing that spins around in your vacuum cleaner to pick up stuff off the rug is what it looked like to me.
And then there's a scene, my favorite scene, where?
When he sleeps in the mustache guard. He
sleeps with a mustache guard that is...
Albert Finney does that in the 74 version.
Oh, I guess.
And then later in the movie, he doesn't sleep with the mustache guard on, and that annoyed me.
But this one, I'll tell you, this mustache guard is so elaborate. It's got... It is as though it was specifically molded to his very configuration of facial hair.
And it had another mustache drawn on top of it.
That is... No. It's like three-dimensional, like extra room for the top stash, as opposed to the base stash that reaches out to his cheeks.
Yes.
Now, you know Kenneth Branagh, he actually grew that thing. I guarantee you he did.
I do not believe that.
Oh, no, he did. I know he did.
I don't think he's capable.
Oh, he is.
He has no lips. I don't think he can grow. I don't think.
That doesn't mean he doesn't have facial hair.
I think there are few mortals who could organically grow that mustache. I do not think that Kenneth Branagh is one of them. I'm sorry.
I want to believe.
Well.
I want to believe that during the course of filming this film, he walked around in real life with that mustache.
I hate to tell you.
I want it to have
happened. That mustache is not real. Also, they did not really kill Johnny Depp. It was for show.
I have thoughts in my head about that.
I'm sure you do, but no.
But I will refrain from them, and what I will say instead is that when I saw Johnny Depp show up in the movie, I thought, oh, I hope he's the murder victim.
Because, just so we get less of him.
Just so we don't have to hear him talk very much. Because if there's someone I'm over, just aesthetically, it's that dude.
It's like he's got an island. He should go there for a while. Let us miss him a little.
There was a time when I was down for him, thought he was cool. Those days are over. I'm bored by him now, and I think he's bored with himself.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Also boring is this movie.
It
looks fantastic, and if you are like me, and I know some of you are, and vintage period production details and period design.
I was going to say, the interiors look good. The
fanciness of luxury train travel in the 1930s.
And I love they figured out a way to do product placement in a movie set in the 1930s.
Godiva
and Dom Perignon.
That Godiva label is front and center.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It looked really cool. The costumes were great.
If we go into the Godiva store, do we think they have like a tie-in box? Where there's like a chocolate that's shaped like Josh Gad's head or something.
I would like Godiva to do a tie-in box that is all of their heads.
That would be great.
That you could eat.
You could pop Olivia Colman in your mouth.
Yes. And so this looks really cool.
The interiors look really cool. And I want to be clear on that.
The because interiors and the costumes look really cool.
Yeah. This was shot on 65mm, although I don't think either of us saw it projected in 70.
I just saw it at the... Where did I see it? The Grove or the Arclight? One of those two places. Okay.
But for all that attention to detail,
if you are old enough, yeah, for all of that attention to detail, it's kind of a bore. There's not much excitement going on.
Well, that and also
even the even if you don't know
how it ends,
and it cannot end in any other way than it has always ended.
Yes,
not in the book, not in the original film. There's a very specific ending in the Agatha Christie estate. Stipulates that if you are going to do this, you're going to keep that ending.
Yeah, like you can tweak the characters a little, like the Doctor is now black, which he was not in the book and in any of the previous versions.
Yeah, it's a good way to differentiate the
And there's a members, there's a couple of lines where they sort of address
all these white people look alike.
Well, of course. There's a couple of lines where they sort of address the idea of like there are certain characters who immediately make him a suspect because, you know, he's not one of us.
Well, yeah.
You know, yeah. But yeah, the Agatha Christie estate doesn't let you change the who in the whodunit. So, if you've seen this before, if you saw the BBC version of the 1974 movie, you know, you already know how this
But
is.
I have gone out of my way to speak to younger people under 30
mm-hmm.
who all except one did not know the ending.
Interesting.
And were relatively enthusiastic about seeing the film. I don't know how they felt about it after they saw it, but it's very good looking and
here's a problem.
Okay.
I think that because Branagh is the writer and director.
Yes.
He gives us a lot more Poirot than we necessarily needed.
That is not what bothered me.
Well, but I think the problem is there is then you get a lot less of everybody else. So if you go in thinking, ooh, you know, Daisy Ridley and Judy Dench and, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer and whoever else.
I thought she was Keira Knightley in the first scene.
Yeah, that's understandable.
She walks up and sits next to him on the bench. I was like, oh, Keira Knightley's in this. And I was like, oh, wait. No, that's Daisy Ridley. Yeah.
but yeah, so you get less of them so that you can have more of Branagh.
Right. And he's got plans, Mr. Brown.
Oh, well, yeah, the movie ends pretty much...
with him talking about the murder
on the... Death on the Nile.
Murder on the Nile, yeah. Or Death on the Nile, or whatever it was called.
Death on the Nile.
So I don't know if this makes a lot of money. I guess we're going to see another one of the with the mustache and the things and the going to Egypt and,
maybe. You know, I have seen... most of the like sort of all-star Agatha Christie movies, but I never got around to Death on the Nile. I need to check that one out. It's like one of Betty Davis's last films.
Yeah, it was.
I am a fan of Evil Under the Sun, though.
I've never seen that.
Ooh, it was on Netflix for a while. Maybe it still is. It's a hoot.
And you know it's old-timey when he describes something as a hoot.
I did not appreciate how gay that movie was when I saw it as a 14-year-old, but I saw it again a couple years ago.
Did you appreciate how gay you were when you were 14?
I did not. That's part of the problem. Yeah. But when I saw the movie a couple of years ago, I was like, oh my God. I mean, first of all, wall-to-wall Cole Porter songs.
Right.
Second of all, Sylvia Miles. Third, it's just sort of one thing after another where this movie, you know, like Roddy McDowell, and it's just like, it's so arch, and you have like Maggie Smith and Diana Rigg as lifelong frenemies saying really catty things about each other. It's just like, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. What could have really elevated this if the characters in this film had interesting, witty things to say.
Yeah.
Instead of them just being props for Branagh to move around as he deduced left and right.
Exactly. It's like the thing about an Agatha Christie adaptation in general, I think, is that, the mystery itself is fun, but you have to spice things up a little bit. Otherwise, everybody's just there as a sort of placeholder who has some role to play in the plot.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all they get to be in this movie. So you don't really get a feel for who any of these other non-Poirot characters are. It's just a question of where were they at 3 a.m., you know, when blah, blah, blah happened, you know?
Right. So, whatever.
Yeah.
The people who are under 30 that I know that went to see it, they took their parents and grandparents.
Well, sure.
And everyone had a very nice time. So, yeah. Cheap matinee, if you're a production design sort of
Yeah,
if aficionado. You're,
if you want to go for the, you know, the ladies' purses and the, you know, hat boxes or whatever.
And I did.
Yeah, no, and that, I always and that, do. That is a valid thing.
It's got Judi Dench being Judi Denchy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Lady Bird. We're finally getting to talk about Lady Bird.
Yes.
Here's a quote from a New York Times piece about Greta Gerwig. What is boyhood but for a girl? What is the 400 blows but for a girl? What is personhood for young women? And that's the story of Lady
Bird. That's Greta Gerwig talking?
I think that's a quote from her. Mm. Yeah. And so this is a movie starring Saoirse Ronan. Saoirse, not Saoirse.
Saoirse. Yeah.
Saoirse Ronan.
Rhymes with inertia.
Yeah. Saoirse Ronan is a high school senior in Sacramento.
It's 2002. It's
2002. And she wants out of Sacramento by any means necessary.
She wants to go east where the writers and the thinkers are.
Right. But everyone around her keeps reminding her that she's not quite good enough to go out and have the life she dreams of.
She doesn't have the grades. She doesn't have the, you know, she's lazy.
Yeah. She is a typical kid.
Yeah.
Who has aspirations beyond what she has demonstrated.
Yes.
To the world.
I've been there.
Well, has everyone? Yes, everyone. Sure. The geniuses of the world, the truly special sparkling people of the world, they are few. And the rest of us, the normies.
Look,
we sit around and we go, I want to do that. I want to get out of here. I want to go places.
You have to remember, do things. I come from a family of ridiculously high school grade point averages.
You really do. It's not just. Let's not short shrift any of them. This is not just a family of ridiculously high school GPAs. This is a family of too much overachievement. Seriously,
I have two brothers who went through Harvard in 3 years.
It's maddening.
My other brother went through Duke in 3 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah,
I went to Texas Tech. It took me seven.
I related to the idea of having like loftier ambitions than you have demonstrable means to achieve them.
Right, right. Because you kicked around during school.
I was doing other things. So I had movies to watch.
And that's what the film is about. The film is about that push and pull of the people you love, your family and your friends, for a variety of reasons. They either don't want you to go, don't believe you can do the thing you think you want to do, don't believe in you, period.
Or they don't want you to get hurt.
They don't want you to get hurt. And they also, perhaps a little selfishly, would just like you to stick around. Because in spite of their occasional, her mother, played by Laurie Metcalf, who is a national treasure.
Oh my God, she's so great in this.
Laurie Metcalf is a national treasure.
Yes, and usually gets to be that treasure on stage or on television.
Yeah.
And this is a movie, finally,
yeah,
that gives her the platform she deserves.
What she says, and this is in the trailer, she's like, you're not going to Yale. Why don't you just do us all a favor, go to junior college, then go to jail, and then come back and try to finish junior college again, and then just do whatever it is you're going to do. And at first you think, this is a cruel mother. But at the same time, as you watch Lady Bird's life unfold, you think, maybe it's not that cruel.
She might be onto something.
She's kind of a pain.
She knows her better than we do.
She's kind of a pain, and she is really erratic in terms of what she says versus what she does, what she aspires to versus what she, you know, can really, have in hand. So you wind up not hating Laurie Metcalf, even though that's how she's introduced to you.
Sure.
You realize that everyone really is going to pull for this girl.
Yeah.
Everyone really is going to send her off and hope for the best. And by the end of the film, this is not a spoiler, you think she can go do it. She can probably go do it.
It is. It's a really great kind of coming of age story, because it's sort of about that tipping point of when you stop being a completely self-obsessed teenager.
Right.
And start grasping the world around you, start grasping...
That you affect other people.
Exactly. That you're...
In your life.
And that your
parents... your actions have consequences.
And that your parents have made sacrifices on your behalf, whether or not you appreciated them or appreciated, you know, any of it. I just think this is an extraordinary movie. It's one
of my favorite movies of this year.
No question.
It is sweet and acidic.
Mm-hmm.
It is... generous with its characters.
Compassionate.
Generous with its actors, because everybody gets everyone gets their bit to do. Yeah.
And a great cast, because in addition to Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf, you've got Tracy Letts and Lucas Hedges, who's also in Three Billboards, and Timothée Chalamet, who's in Call Me By Your Name, which we'll be talking about very soon.
Yeah.
Beanie Feldstein.
First of all, that's a fantastic name. Secondly... She plays the best friend.
Yeah.
And she's so prickly and funny and exactly responsive in the way that you want her to be.
Yeah.
And she's Jonah Hill's sister.
Yes, she was in Neighbors 2.
All right.
She's one of the three main girls in Neighbors 2 were Chloe Grace Moretz and What's-Her-Face from Dope and Beanie Feldstein.
And so she is, is Feldstein Jonah Hill's last name?
I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know.
It's a Shirley MacLaine Warren Beatty situation.
Yeah, who's up? What? Do you know that one?
I think their real last name is Beatty with one T.
Okay.
And I think he added the T and she went with like her mother's maiden name or something.
Oh.
Yeah.
Shirley MacLaine sounds cooler than Shirley Beatty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Too many, it's too assonant.
Right. Assonant.
God. You are such a child. Anyway, Lady Bird is great. Go see it.
It is. So, one more thing before we move on to DVD picks. It's just that first-time filmmaker, Greta Gerwig.
Oh, my God. No,
She has absorbed...
Well, actually, technically, no. She co-directed Nights and Weekends back in her Queen of Mumblecore era.
Oh, all right. That's Joe Swanberg.
Yes, but for all intents and purposes, her solo writing-directing debut. In my review on The Wrap, I talked about how often with a first film from an actor... The performances are going to be great, and they have, and they've cast, they've called in a lot of favors, and so every awesome actor is in it, but they don't necessarily have the broader strokes of filmmaking style. Whereas here, this is somebody who is already clearly a storyteller,
right,
and really knows how to use the editing and the cinematography and different things to really kind of capture stuff. There's a montage at the beginning of the film that really sort of gives you a quick idea of what going to Catholic school is like. And then there's a great one at the end of the film that really sort of addresses how, while Lady Bird was dying to get out of Sacramento, at the same time she was paying very close attention to Sacramento, and it's going to be something that she's going to carry with her even if she's an East Coast girl for the rest of her life.
So I'm incredibly impressed by this.
Yeah.
And my DVD pick is 20th Century Women from last year. Mike Mills' film that didn't get enough attention.
No, it didn't. I was surprised.
That got critical attention.
Yeah, but I think people thought that was, surely Annette Bening will get an Oscar nomination, and
right.
did not.
And it missed that thing, and therefore it missed a wider audience. The Academy Awards do have a a purpose, and they are to draw your attention to films that star Annette Bening.
Exactly.
Also Greta Gerwig and Elle Fanning and, you know, other folks.
Billy Crudup.
Yeah. So, watch that one.
Yeah,
It's so terrific.
I'm going to say the 1974 Murder on the Orient Express, directed by Sidney Lumet. A lot of fun, a lot more fun than the Branagh version, and I think totally holds up. You know, it is... There are flashes here and there of the fact that you're seeing the 70s, 30s. But for the most part, I think it gets the details right, the hair right, all that kind of stuff that usually, you know, sort of stumps a period piece. And it's just, it's a fun little mystery, even if you already know the resolution to it. So, you know, if you've never seen it, or if you've only seen the Branagh version now and you want to go back, I'd say totally check it out.
Got some letters.
Okay.
This is from Ben. He's talking about the Frederick Wiseman documentary Ex Libris.
Mm.
And he provides a link, a Portland film critic who, in his words, our local alternative weekly critic didn't, and this is in quotes, get it.
I believe her headline was something like, Ex Libris will put you to sleep.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
Hang on, I'm clicking on this right now so I can see what the, oh yeah, Ex Libris will put you to sleep. Well, Megan Burbank, you're wrong, first of all.
Shame
on you. Yeah, shame on you. So he continues. His letter begins, I will accept her comments about narration. I don't know what those comments are, but I'm sure they were negative ones. Only because I remember reading an article a while back, which I cannot locate, that outlined how unique the New York City Public Library is. It is a separate nonprofit that is not part of a municipal, county, or other taxing district. Seems like this could be interesting to fill out a bit, as most public libraries are truly public and tied to the local government somehow. Okay, fine. I'm still thinking of going. Please do. This is from October, so I assume it's gone now, but...
I hope you went.
I hope you did. Because I made it through The Store, which is a 1983 Wiseman documentary about the 1982 Christmas shopping season at the flagship downtown Dallas Neiman Marcus store.
Yes, which is a relatively brisk 90 minutes, about half the length of Ex Libris.
Yeah. He says, I'm still thinking of going because I made it through The Store, which I know Dave loves because it's at Neiman Marcus. And I liked because I miss when department stores were fancy. The end. Well, okay, now. I love it because it's a Frederick Wiseman film. But I do have an extra bit of love in it, a love for it, because of its Neiman Marcus location. Because
there's something very Dallas-y about it.
It's a very Texas
thing. The customers and the employees. Yeah.
And, you know, having lived in Texas for so long, Neiman Marcus felt like a part of the Texas experience.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I moved here to Los Angeles, I used to like doing my Christmas shopping at Neiman Marcus because it felt like a chunk of Texas stuck in the middle of Beverly Hills.
Oh, the one here, yes, right.
That is no longer the case, as they have completely renovated their entire operation, and now it's all just like stupid clothes. it's not a department store really anymore.
True.
It's a really high end clothing boutique now.
I mean, did they take all the Epicurean stuff out?
Almost everything is gone, except for clothes and, like, fragrances and makeup. And, like, the jewelry is still up top on the second level. But now everything is, like, you know, makeup.
And there are two restaurants.
Three. There's a downstairs restaurant.
Right.
There's a middle-level cafe, and there's an upstairs men's department bar cafe area.
I have never seen the middle cafe.
Well, because we escalator ourselves right past it, because it's right in the middle of all the, like, ladies' underpants.
Wow. Yeah. But, I mean, we go through that floor just to get to the escalators, and I didn't even register in my...
Yeah. Well, someone in this house pays a little less attention to everything.
Fine.
Than someone else.
The last time that you and I ate at the men's department bar was the last time that I saw the late Bill Paxton.
Oh, that's right. He was there with his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. End of that story.
Yeah, man, sorry, I didn't have any. They didn't have a button for that one.
Wilson, somewhat longish letter. I will read the whole thing and then we will discuss it.
Okay.
As a librarian, I have a thing about people who want to ban books, particularly the sanctimonious types who want to ban a book they have never read. This is what it sounded like trying to find out if the movie 9/11 was exploitive trash or a sincere dramatic feature. I know that Davis Interruptus is a running bit on the podcast, but the show is only an hour long. I had hope for this movie when I heard that it was also a play called The Elevator. As plays are rarely written for the quick buck, national and personal tragedies have always been fertile ground for drama and a means for artists and audiences to process experience. The play, I understand, seeks to portray human drama shared during trauma. It's entirely possible that this movie has something to offer. The Other Side of the Phone Call, for example. The fact that they changed the name to 9/11 and hired Charlie Sheen didn't bode well, but it would be nice to hear what a film critic whom I trust and who sat through it had to say about it. Dave, I have to ask, how soon is too soon? Is it still too soon for movies about 9/11? It's been 15 years. There were lighthearted movies about World War II before it was even over. Alonso cited that From Here to Eternity came out in 1953, but Claudette Colbert and Ray Milland starred in Arise, My Love, and Clark Gable and Hedy Lamarr headlined Comrade X in 1940. Orson Welles' The Stranger came out in 1946 and featured actual footage of concentration camps. I don't think they had even finished sweeping up from V-Day yet. Perhaps you feel like I do, that the 9/11 attacks were so immediately and completely co-opted by terrible politicians and used to justify the twisting of American values that we have become suspect of anyone's invocation of the numbers. If the movie had also been titled The Elevator, should it still never have been made? What if Whoopi Goldberg had had a better wig? I don't think this movie is too soon, as much as it may not be very good. I ask this because the podcast just featured Alonzo's review of the based on the true story Stronger and the Boston Marathon bombing, and there was not one mention of too soon. Love the show.
Well, you're right. Dave needs to shut up and let me talk. That's absolutely an issue with this show, and I'm so glad that you pointed it out.
In my defense, it's less of an issue than it was 7 years ago. I'm so much better now about not interrupting you. Well, don't
maybe,
you agree?
Maybe 7 years from now, you'll you be even better.
I think you should automatically agree.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. Here's where my bias comes in. I do feel like what you said, people who have come in and co-opted 9/11 for their own weirdo, jingoistic, warmongering, flag-waving, garbage ways. I will also say that my own personal reaction to 9/11 was, even for a person who was not there, who was in Los Angeles and experienced it on television, pretty traumatic. Like, it freaked me out for, I will say this, literally months. I was not anyone's good company in the last few months of 2001. So, when I see a movie coming out about it, I'm just like, no, do not want. So, yeah, just me. I mean, it is 15 years ago. 16 now.
Yeah, the Boston Marathon bombing was more recent.
Right, right.
But that one didn't hit you in the same way.
That one didn't hit me in the same way.
All right.
So I guess we all pick and choose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But I see what you're saying. Sure, I guess there could be 9/11 movies. I mean, you're right. The World War II movies were happening during World War II.
Christmas in Connecticut opens with a U-boat hitting a transport ship with a torpedo.
Right.
And two people survive. And that's the opening of a comedy. That's the wacky setup.
Wilson has sent us another email. So he gets two.
Well,
yeah. And he says, Special subject line, special guests. I'm now trying to change from what?
Remember he made the joke about how he wanted to make your voice his growler profile picture?
I am now trying to change my Scruff profile
picture
from Dave White's voice to Johnny Jungle Gut's voice.
Well, there you go.
All about that bass. Mr. Jungle Guts has the boomin' bass voice. It's true.
That's true, because his larynx is gigantic. Because he's 10 feet tall.
He's 6'12". How tall is he?
Very.
6'6", 6'7", 6'8".
He's 6'7".
He's up there. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds right.
He's a very statuesque young man.
He is indeed.
Yeah. I guess we're done.
All right. Well, hey, sorry about the delay on this one. We'll be following up shortly with this week's new movies.
Listen, back to back in it. We're doing another one in 5 minutes.
So I'll do my rant at the end of the next, not a rant, but my, the list of other shows and whatnot. But in the meantime, you know, you can always follow us online at LinoleumCast and Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could subscribe for free at iTunes. Please go leave us a 5-star review. That would be super helpful. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And hey, join our club, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Get more shows, get fun prizes, get a sense of that you're helping the art of podcasting.
That's the stupidest thing anyone has ever said on
this show. Yeah, I felt ridiculous coming out. Anyway, all right, we'll be back shortly. Until next time.
Goodbye.